Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. CNI stands against America's negative role in the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the war party's relentless push to bomb Iran, and the roles played by twisted Christian Zionism and neocon-engineered Islamophobia in justifying it all. The Council for the National Interest works tirelessly to expose and oppose our government's most destructive policies, but they can't do it without you. Support CNI's push to straighten out America's crooked course. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and click donate under About Us at the top of the page. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's the Scott Horton Show. Live here on No Agenda Radio from 11 to 1 Texas time every weekday, less Thursday. Though we're working on that. And, of course, you can find the full interview archives at scotthorton.org, and you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. All right? So, we're way late, but our next guest, our final guest on the show today is our good friend Sheldon Richmond from the Future Freedom Foundation. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Scott. Thanks for inviting me back. Hope you're doing all right.
I'm doing great. I appreciate you joining us today, and I always appreciate your writings. At the very least, you write one every Friday at fff.org. TGIF. The goal is freedom. Liberty, security, and terrorism is the latest. And I guess you're trying to give us some sage advice about how not to knee-jerk and mess ourselves up here.
Well, yeah, there's actually two parts to the article. The first one is about... they're just trying to caution people that giving up our freedom, what's left of it, to the government is no path to security. It's a false promise. We wouldn't be safer. In fact, we'd be more danger. We'd be in more danger because the government would have all this extra power. So.
Yeah, but you know what? What if there weren't all those cameras around to take pictures of the bombers? It's a good thing we have a surveillance state. We need even more. I saw Field Marshal Blomberg, the mayor of New York City, said we just need more power, obviously, because we almost didn't have enough in this case.
Well, isn't the funny thing, though, that these were private cameras that that were mainly relied on?
Yeah.
The cameras, the Lord and Taylor cameras, they weren't government. I don't think the government should have cameras everywhere. You know, they always talk about how you have no expectation of privacy when you walk out on the street. Well, I'm sorry. I have an expectation that the government is not recording my every movement when I walk on the street. I don't care what the Supreme Court says. Yeah. That's my expectation. If I go into a private store, I probably have an expectation that they have cameras around to guard against shoplifting and whatnot. Although they should put a sticker in the window, and a lot of them do anyway. They do say we have cameras on site, surveillance cameras on site, but I don't think the government should be doing that.
Yeah. Well, and look, the local gas station doesn't have the power to imprison you and you know, hack your bank account and ruin your life and do whatever they want. They're simply, you know, cameras in self-defense and have no other purpose, you know, unless,
right.
You know, the executive order of 2017 that mandates that all cameras, you know, centralize their feeds straight into the NSA stream or something like that. But we're not there yet.
No, as I say in the article, it's not a coincidence that every dystopian novel and movie, like 1984 and, you know, you name it, Brazil, include in their ugly picture of those societies 24-hour surveillance. You know, we identify that with something bad, something horrible. So why are we slipping into this? We need to think very carefully about this. Now, you know...
Before you go further, let's stay on the cameras for just a second here, because, you know, it's been 10 or 15 years since we all got cameras in every American city, right? It's been quite a while that the American people have already decided that, hey, I mean, really, they tend to just seem to use them for traffic control and you know, maybe to give you a red light ticket, but we haven't seen in the 15 years a martial law crackdown that used the cameras. Apparently they were put there for the stated purpose, which is just to help you find the quickest route home from work, that kind of thing. The American people have internalized that, really?
Yeah.
What's the big deal? And I'd point out, too, and I've said this before, but They never held a vote on it anywhere. They never even asked any population of any town. They just did it in every jurisdiction in America, 18,000 counties or something like that, went and, and just put the cameras up, which is something, but they got away with it clean, I think.
Well, there's many precedents for the government to begin something very small scale and gradual, get people used to it, and then have it grow over the years. The income tax is a great example. Go back and look at what the income tax was like in, when it was first passed, the current one in 1913. You know, only the very richest were going to pay. Even there, they were going to pay only a little bit, and it was just, we were assured that it would, you know, never be any big deal. Same thing with Social Security; the tax was very low. And the people were told, you know, don't worry about this. And then over the years it grows because people get used to it. Well, you know, same thing. Get the cameras there mainly as, you know, for traffic purposes, catch speeders and people running red lights. But then they're there and you can put more up when something like this happens. Now, you know, one thing, I don't want to sound alarmist. I don't really see a lot of talk about this now or it gaining much traction. So, you know, I'm hoping it's not I'm hoping any hysteria over Boston has now passed, and we're not going to see some big rush to turn us into a total surveillance state. We're already a partial surveillance state. But as I said on Facebook, you know, if we turn into a full surveillance state, the terrorists win. And I mean that seriously.
Yeah. Well, of course, that's the whole thing. Like Will Gregg was trying to teach us back in 2001, the action is in the reaction. Mm-hmm. So the terrorists, if they can't either chase us away by attacking us, they can try to use judo and slam us into the wall, right? Bleed us to death with 10,000 cuts, that kind of thing. But another part of it, as Will Gregg explained in 2001 in the New American Magazine, is to get our government to clamp down on all of us in their desperation to prevent this kind of thing from continuing to happen on their watch, and then to turn us, therefore, obviously, all against them. And it, maybe one day we'll all wake up and say, hey, government, if the choice is leaving the Middle East or continuing to enforce this Orwellian police state on us, we'd rather just call off the wars, you know? And that's what they're trying to get us to do. And I guess it just so happens that we got no right to wage these wars or back these kingdoms in the first place. And so it's the right thing to do anyway. It's the wrong thing that's provoked the terrorism. But so this is part of it in the first place, is to get us to resent all the new security measures and the changing of our society into this new, worse thing than it used to be.
Well, I think that reaction point, Will Griggs, is very good, and it's worth making over and over again. It's certainly true. I mean, if they quote, they hate us for our freedom, which I don't believe, but if they hate us for our freedom, the government has a very efficient way to make sure they have no cause to hate us anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Namely, take away our freedom. It's a point that's been made over and over again, but it's more than just a laugh line. Yeah, if they take away our freedom, then I guess they'll have no reason to hate us.
Right. I don't know how that logic went out, but I guess it did, you know? It seems to me, just stop killing people, you know? I don't know.
Well, yeah, and of course the real problem is that that's not why anybody hates us. you know, as I said in an earlier article earlier this week, there was all this interest in the motive for the Boston Marathon bombings. But I sort of predicted that the motive, interest in the motive, would evaporate, especially official interest, if it really does turn out that it was resentment against the wars and the general trashing of the Muslim world by U.S. foreign policy, mm-hmm. Not just the wars, but you know, everything else, including the continued oppression of Palestine. Then suddenly, I think we won't be talking about the motive; that will disappear.
Yep. Well, and it's already pretty much happened as far as TV goes. And the thing of it is that, you know, I think the war party would, you know, David Frum or some guy like that would have an argument that, hey, listen, we had to do these wars, and if we have to suffer some blowback, I mean, guys died in the Battle of the Bulge, right? But that didn't mean that we're going to stop marching toward Berlin. You know, these things happen. There are casualties in a war, but they started it, and so we have to finish it, and what we've been doing is toward that end. It seems like probably if they if they made that argument on TV, they'd get away with looking like they were making sense or whatever, but they don't even want to have that argument at all,
yeah,
because apparently they're scared that it just rings too hollow at this point, that the American people know that actually, nah, we started it. It was Bill Clinton murdered all those people from bases in Saudi Arabia is what brought this on.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, I don't know why they don't forthrightly say, you know, okay, this is the price we have to pay. Although we can, you know, crack down at home to make sure we minimize the price, but this is the price we pay for our just foreign policy of fighting wars and supporting Israel, no matter what, and go down the list. They let them be forthright and lay it all out.
But, yeah, they'd rather just ignore it.
They're obviously afraid to do that.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want a reconsideration because that could possibly set off a reconsideration of our foreign policy. And they just don't want that. I mean, it's just taken as a given that the U.S. is the world policeman. Look what's happening in Syria now with the alleged reports of use of sarin gas, which we don't know. Maybe true, maybe not. We don't know. But it's just a given that if they find out that the sarin gas was used, then we're in one way or another. It may not be putting troops in, but no-fly zone and drones maybe and so-called, you know, lethal aid to the right people. Of course, they know exactly who the right people are, and it's just taken as a given. And I don't hear Americans saying, "Oh, hold on a second, why do we get into it if they use sarin gas?" I mean, first of all, you can kill. You know, bombs are weapons of mass destruction too. Somebody pointed out today, you know, why pick on chemical weapons? Obviously they're terrible. But they're not the only terrible weapon. The U.S. has a whole bunch of terrible weapons it uses.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was even a case, and a judge finally said no to this or something. There was one case where a guy was charged with shooting four or five people with a handgun, and the prosecutor, and it wasn't even political, and he wasn't even a Muslim. And it was just, you know, a regular run-of-the-mill American crime kind of a thing. And the prosecutor tried to charge him with using a weapons of mass destruction in that case under that statute. And the judge said, come on, there's got to be a line somewhere as to what counts as a weapon of mass destruction. I mean, presumably you could use a handgun and a lot of magazines to kill a lot of people if you were in a real big gun-free zone somewhere or something. But WMD is supposed to mean nuclear bomb. That's what it means. You could kill a city all at once, 100,000 people or worse at once. That's a weapon of mass destruction. And really, we were talking about this earlier on the show about how when they conflate pretended Ebola weapons or canisters of mustard gas with atom bombs, they're lying in the first place. They want to conflate a pipe bomb or a handgun with that. We're now way off into ridiculous land.
Well, this came up during, maybe you remember this, this came up during the build-up to the Iraq War, where, you know, when WMD became, you know, such a popular phrase for the American people, because we heard it every day, 100 times a day. And I forget who wrote the article, but I said, wait a second, they've broadened the definition of WMD. That WMD meant nuclear weapons, where you could, like you said, wipe out a city. So it's interesting to see that point revisited.
It's just like the Democrats with assault weapon, right? They take assault rifle. Oh, that means fully automatic rifle. Pretty simple. And then they go assault weapon. Oh, that means a gun that looks scary to a Democrat.
Right. Right.
Same thing.
Yeah, so
it's like just like Orwell with the cameras, Orwell with the language, too.
Yeah,
that was my
was
favorite part
say,
of 1984.
That's right.
Was the dictionary.
Book, everybody should read that book or reread that book once a year and pay close attention to the language aspect, because that's just so important. I mean, the word terrorist, I mean, I talked about this in the piece that you referred to.
Mm-hmm.
The word terrorist is used that way, too. For one thing, it's sort of by definition can't be applied to anything the U.S. or its allies do. So even if the U.S. uses or Israel uses violence against noncombatants for political purposes, which, you know, they do every day, for God's sakes, that can't be terrorism. So terrorism has to always apply to an enemy of the United States or an enemy of one of its allies. And then I also made other distinctions that, you know, terrorism does have to have a political aspect. So we don't, you know, I would argue that we don't yet know that the bombings were terrorist in the sense of having a political objective. Maybe we'll find that out. There's indications because we have statements coming out of the hospital room. But the guy was sedated, and we don't know who's doing the leaking and what purpose the person might have. I mean, I think we still need to wait. I mean, I'm feeling sort of confident that it had a political purpose and it was a reaction to the U.S. violence against Muslims, but that doesn't mean I know that. So I would still wait. I mean, we don't talk about the Boston Strangler as a terrorist. He wasn't a terrorist because he didn't have a political goal. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with the guy that climbed up in the, you know, the University of Texas tower back in whatever it was, the 60s, and started shooting people, Charles Whitman. He wasn't a terrorist, but he terrorized people, but that's not enough to be a terrorist.
Right. Yeah, the Unabomber, on the other hand, there's your, you know, cookie-cutter example perfectly, right there, attacking
yeah.
civilians in order to influence
right.
culture, et cetera.
And,
you know, Bill Clinton,
it does seem to me part of the definition that you're hitting non-combatants. I mean, this is in the, it seems to right. be at least implied in the official definitions in the Oxford English Dictionary, and that would rule out, as I point out in the article, the Fort Hood shootings. That was a military installation.
Right.
That's not terrorism. If you attack the military, that doesn't count as, that should not count as terrorism.
It seemed like it because it was such a massacre because it was a gun-free zone there
yeah,
at Fort Hood.
Clinton had forbade them to carry sidearms in a military installation. So, there's another gun lesson there, of course. How far would that guy have gotten if everybody had a sidearm?
Yeah.
Maybe he would have killed one person.
You know, Bill Clinton, speaking of Clinton, here's the quote from an interview he did with foreignpolicy.com a couple of years back. I think mm-hmm. we've talked about this before. Terror means killing and robbery and coercion by people who do not have state authority. And of course, he means our state, right? Because the Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is just some kind of special forces in Iran, oh, no, that counts. Those are terrorists because they're Iranians. Doesn't matter if they work directly for the Ayatollah or not. You know,
but yeah, I think it's pretty funny because it looks so obviously rigged if you say it that way.
Right.
But the first guy I read taking apart this concept of terrorism was Noam Chomsky, and that goes back I think to the 80s, early 90s. He was pointing out how it's a rigged definition. It's what Ayn Rand would call an anti-concept because it's really politically motivated, right? It does exempt the U.S., Israel, and America's other allies. In their official actions, no matter how terrorizing their conduct,
right.
and no matter how many how large a population they terrorize, it's for a political purpose, but that can't get counted as terrorism. Terrorism is only back then it was Palestinians who were trying to get attention and retaliate for the harm they've suffered, which isn't to justify it when you're hitting non-combatants, but it does help to try to understand things.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and you know, the thing is about it is it's a shame because the term very well applies to some private, stateless terrorist groups who murder civilians, and mm-hmm. Al-Qaeda is just one of them. But you're right that it's still so loaded because, by definition, in its definition, it excludes not just state terrorism, but especially the very worst terrorism in the world, the terrorism of the U.S. government, which quantifiably causes more grief and pain and death than any other force on the planet.
Yeah, just,
combined,
probably. Here's an experiment. Next time you're at a cocktail party or something, and you hear some discussion of, say, the Boston bombings or something, just say, hey, you know who else commits terrorism? The U.S. government. And see what kind of reaction you get. There's a good test.
Yeah, and if you need examples, just stay tuned to this show because we'll be continuing to cover Iran's sanctions and Pakistan drone strikes and outraged widows and farmers in Yemen and people in torture dungeons beneath Mogadishu in Somalia and on from here on out. There will never run out of examples. You know,
yeah.
In fact, one of my favorite to this day, favorite in a dark, evil kind of way, is the one that my wife, Larissa Alexandrovna, she busted them, that the torture dungeon in Poland had been a Nazi base. And then it was a Soviet base. And then it was an American CIA torture prison. How do you like that?
Well, it seems to make sense.
I mean, man, that really bothers me in a way. You know what it does? It challenges the kind of my very, very, like, early age public school brainwashing about. There is something to believe in about this country, damn it. And I just, that starts getting threatened when it comes to stories like that, that there's anything worth salvaging here. Damn.
Or it just shows you the degree to which these political leaders have disgraced the United States. Anything noble about the United States, they have so stained it. And I was just sickened this week watching the festivities and ceremonies at the George Bush Library. In fact, I can't even say that term without getting a bit nauseated. But everybody was up there. All the ex-presidents were, and the current president, lauding this guy. You know, because when push comes to shove, the ruling class sticks together.
Got that right.
And power above party any day.
That's Sheldon Richman, everybody. He's vice president of Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org. And check out his blog at sheldonrichman.com, too. Thanks very much, Sheldon.
Great, Scott. Thank you. Anytime.
Man, you need some Liberty stickers for the back of your truck. At libertystickers.com, they've got great state hate, like Pearl Harbor was an inside job. The Democrats want your guns. U.S. Army, die for Israel. Police brutality, not just for black people anymore. And government school, why you and your kids are so stupid. Check out these and 1,000 other great ones at libertystickers.com. And of course, they'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. That's libertystickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here, inviting you to check out WallStreetWindow.com. It's a financial blog written by former hedge fund manager Mike Swanson, who's investing in commodities, mining stocks, and European markets. Wall Street Window is unique in that Mike shows people what he's really investing in and updates you when he buys or sells in his main account. Mike thinks his positions are going to go up because of all the money the Federal Reserve is printing to finance the deficit. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. And Mike's got a great new book coming out, so also keep your eye on writermichaelswanson.com for more details. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/Scott Horton Show for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there. Hey y'all, Scott here. Like I told you before, the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org represents the best of the libertarian movement. Led by the fearless Jacob Hornberger, FFF writers James Bovard, Sheldon Richman, Wendy McElroy, Anthony Gregory, and many more write the op-eds and the books, host the events, and give the speeches that are changing our world for the better. Help support the Future Freedom Foundation. Subscribe to their magazine, The Future of Freedom. Or to contribute, just look for the big red donate button at the top of fff.org. Peace and freedom. Thank you.